Hey Fresh Capital listeners, in this week we're talking about one of the world's most controversial investors, SoftBank. Known for investing in the world's most successful startups like Alibaba and Uber, SoftBank began as a simple Japanese telecom business. Under its founder, Masayoshi Son, however, SoftBank has gone on to become one of the most successful venture capitalist firms in the world. Its hits and misses create swings of billions of dollars. This was a really fun episode. Keep listening and enjoy. Welcome to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn about companies and investing. My name is Dan. Joining me, Albert. How are you doing?
Dan, I'm going good. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday for yesterday. Thank you. We've seen quite a bit of each other over the last couple of days. Essentially had two birthday dinners, which I'm very grateful for.
Good Italian eating over this week, I think.
Yeah, pasta and pizza in separate occasions. So really, really good. We're sort of going to another part of the world, though. This episode, talking about SoftBank. Hadn't realized it was a public company, Albert, until you called it out. So really interested in diving into SoftBank. What made you think of SoftBank for this week's episode?
So I've been in the news this week because they recently came out with their Q1 earnings and they've lost a bunch of money, a crazy amount of money actually, as a result of kind of the tech crash and the macro environment. And, you know, given that we've predominantly started to focus more on Asia tech, I just thought it was the perfect company to talk about this week.
Yeah, it's a great company to talk about. And I think it really fits the brief of what we're doing at Fresh Cap now. For those that don't know, SoftBank essentially started and still is a Japan-based sort of telecom company, but it's now expanding more into an e-commerce tech conglomerate. It has key assets like a 28, soon to be less stake in Alibaba. It used to own a substantial amount in the semiconductor chip designer Arm Holdings, which got sold off to Nvidia. And they've, you know, been invested in a whole host of big names like Uber, Didi, Coupang, some of the companies we've talked about. So a really interesting business that evolved from their sort of core consumer business out into something like a venture capitalist company. So really interested to dive into this one. Albert, where do you want to start with introducing SoftBank?
Yeah, so good overview. I don't know whether it's worth first talking about what SoftBank does or talking about Masa, who is the man and brains behind SoftBank. So I think probably let's double click on Masa as a founder and an investor, because he's just kind of this huge personality behind SoftBank.
Yeah, so Masa established the company as the head chair CEO. He's a really kind of eccentric guy. You can push back on this, Albert, but the way I sort of look at his timeline is he sort of obviously has been working with SoftBank in the telecom business for a while, doing very, very well, and then sort of made a side bet on Alibaba, about a $20 million investment at the time, which now is just multiplied by so much that is just wildly successful, billions and billions of dollars. And that sort of became the brainchild of what is now reflected in SoftBank, the company, which is rather than just having its consumer and enterprise telecom business, now they're actively playing in the VC realm. So to me, I sort of see that as the initial instigator of, wow, look at all this money I made on this side bet with Alibaba. Maybe I should do this full time. And he's really got this tech AI lens to his investments based off that initial one. Do you think that's sort of like a right characterization?
Oh, I mean, potentially, but we can start to dive more into this. I think it is worth calling out that when he launched SoftBank, he did grow it into a substantial business. And so it started as a business that predominantly distributed, you know, software as well as games. So he imported Pac-Man, Space Invaders into Japan, you know, famously grew kind of the business into what it is. So not just software, but also telco and a bunch of other things. It listed in the early 90s, I think I've got in my notes here, and then started to do a few acquisitions. And then it was only at the turn of the century that he turned SoftBank into a holding company with his first investment, Yahoo. So previous to Alibaba, kind of the first big investment that Masa made was Yahoo.
Yeah, and that's obviously worked out very, very well for him. They've bolted on other acquisitions, and now we're just talking about sort of SoftBank's consumer business. You know, they've got the Line app, which is very similar to WhatsApp in Japan, over 90 million users. So, you know, there's a world where we talk about this episode, Albert, just focusing on SoftBank's consumer enterprise businesses, which are very, very profitable, have millions of users, and really have, you know, predominant market share in Japan. But I think what both of us found particularly interesting about SoftBank is this sort of venture capital holding company arm, where they're just investing billions of dollars in some of the hottest tech companies, not just in Japan, not just in Asia, but around the world. What are you seeing from that part of the business, Albert? Let's dive into that part.
Yeah, so I think if we talk about venture capital more broadly, and so the aim of the game is to basically invest in the next unicorn business or the next high growth technology business. So VCs will generally invest in a private technology company in the hopes that it can return a huge multiple on their initial capital. And, you know, there's various stages. And I think we did a simple sprout on VC if anyone wants to check it out. But what the purpose of VC is generally is to make an investment that will return the overall size of the fund. So if we talk about SoftBank's Vision Fund, their first Vision Fund, where they had kind of two or three sets of investors, SoftBank Group, Masa, and the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, they invested almost around $100 billion as a fund. And so I think the first fund had probably around kind of $100 billion all up from a number of different investors. So the point of that is to make an investment that will ultimately return $100 billion. And so they do that by making a number of different investments in the hopes that that business will eventually grow to $100 billion. And you can start to see that play out broadly in the VC landscape, but over what SoftBank's done. And so I'm going to list out some of the investments they made in their first fund. They invested, you know, almost $20 billion into WeWork. You know, we kind of all know where that story goes, that WeWork now, definitely not worth that much, but potentially could be. They invested almost $10 billion, about $9 billion into Uber, and that's performed really well for them. They invested into ARM, the microchip processor, and they almost returned about 5x this year on ARM, into NVIDIA, into Flipkart, who we just covered, and a few other businesses, Opendoor, that we covered as well. And so what SoftBank is doing is deploying large amounts of capital in the hopes that it can return, you know, over $100 billion.
Yeah, and just to go deeper into that mechanic of, well, how are they actually getting this return? You mentioned one of the ways, Albert, with the semiconductor business. You know, they could just be buying in, investing in a company early. As it builds up, becomes more valuable, then another company comes along and says they want to acquire it, and they sell to that company at a higher price. You know, that's an easy way. And the other, you know, way is that company eventually IPOs. So as this young hot tech company matures, gets bigger, you know, a lot of founders want to exit and get their payday, and investors are no different. They go to IPO, and a really good example of that is Coupang, the South Korean e-merchant business that we talked about a couple of weeks ago on the pod. You know, that investment alone got SoftBank about $24 billion in profit based on the time they invested in and then what they sold at the IPO sort of price. So, yeah, that's the bones of the business. That's how they make their money.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to note that SoftBank was doing really well in the bull market. And, you know, not everything is realized gains, because some of the companies they invested in were still private. They hadn't managed to sell them. And so they had what we call paper returns. So like what they estimate their returns are going to be, not necessarily their realized returns. And it was performing incredibly well. And now that there's been a bit of a tech correction, you know, inflation has driven and interest rates have driven the market to decline. There's obviously lots of kind of macro factors here. SoftBank aren't doing particularly great. You know, they just came out with their Q1 earnings, and it's been a pretty huge loss, and the first time they've actually done two quarters straight of a loss. So pretty dire times at the moment for SoftBank.
Yeah, but that's a good point to pivot, Albert, because I think when you look at venture caps, look at these funds, you kind of have to take a long-term lens to it, don't you? Because there's going to be rises and falls in the market. And ultimately, if we believe in the fund, it's because we believe in their strategy. You know, over the long term, it's going to be successful. So if we start thinking about the strategy that SoftBank is implementing, I found it kind of unique. I found it novel. I found it kind of interesting. This idea of 300 years of growth, and that their thesis is that the world is entering the next chapter of transformation, driven particularly by artificial intelligence, AI, across all sorts of industries, and that the next 20 years will bring greater innovation and disruption than the past 300 years. What do you think of that thesis, Albert? That's what they're investing in. Those are the companies they're looking for.
Yeah, I don't, you know, disagree with the SoftBank thesis. I think what they're looking at, you know, in a very broad sense, is almost very generic. So it's like, we believe that AI is going to be important. And I think that holds true. So I don't necessarily think that is a very nuanced or specific thesis. And there is a lot of nuance behind the people who invest on behalf of SoftBank and their finance managers, etc. I think the key thing to call out with SoftBank, because they're such a large fund, they have to deploy large amounts of capital. And that means they're deploying capital into companies that are quite mature and further along the stage of their growth. And so they're investing, say, like $5 to $10 billion in companies. Like, those companies generally have to be worth already quite a lot of money in order to take that form of investment. So there's only a few number of companies, particularly in the AI space, who are private, or even public, who are going to be that sized. For SoftBank, they don't have, how do I put this? They don't have their pick in terms of like who they can actually start to invest in, because they've just got so much money. They've got to play at these later stage, more mature companies. And even though they are long-term investors, those more mature companies are affected by changes in public markets.
Well, I want to pause you on that one, Albert, because I want you to explain that. Why is it that just because they've got a lot of money, $100 billion, or why can't they make small investments, $10 million, $20 million investments in companies? What's the problem there?
Yeah, so good question. So venture capital is driven by this rule called the power law. And so the power law is kind of the applied Pareto principle, in that the majority of returns is going to be driven by a handful of investments. So in venture capital, super risky asset class, you know, I'm going to say like 90 out of 100 startups probably don't make it. And of the 10 of the 100 who do make it, you know, maybe one of them will be the next, you know, unicorn, the next Canva, the next Ubers, etc. And then the other 9 will probably just be like, you know, pretty successful businesses. I think if you contextualize that only 1 out of 100 was going to be your home run, and you need to return from that one $100 billion, which is the SoftBank fund, you need to start backwards calculating how much is that company going to be worth in order to return that, and then how much ownership do I need to take? So it can get quite mathy, but if you're trying to return $100 billion, that means that you need to have a company that's worth substantially more than $100 billion. So let's say the company is worth $1 trillion. If you own 10% of that business, then you can return $100 billion. And so then you've got to find a company where you can invest in at the right stage to own 10% of that company, in the hopes that it will be, that 10% will be enough to return your entire fund. Does that kind of make sense, Dan?
Yeah, it does. It's sort of the strategy, the game isn't to get 10, 20 investments that add up to $100 billion, you know, $5 billion each or $10 billion each. It's you are trying to get that one, maybe two companies to get to that level.
That's such a good call out, because some people will often say like, why does it have to be the billion or trillion dollar company? Why can't you just invest in businesses that could just add up in aggregate to that? And the answer is like, it's just as hard. Like, it's just as hard to find a business that's going to return, you know, $100 million as it is for a business to return, you know, $1 billion, you know, dollars. And so when you're allocating capital in such a risky asset class, like SoftBank is, like, you're really looking for the big home run that returns your fund, and everything else may not return your fund or may return, you know, piecemeals of your fund.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm just looking at SoftBank's gross assets, and this was back in 2021, and obviously valuations have gone a long way down since then. But, you know, their stake in Alibaba, which is about 20 to 25%, that was worth $150 billion. So, you know, that's the type of investment, the type of home run, which they're trying to make. And if we think about it, there's only a couple of Alibaba deals out there every decade. That's the one that they're trying to hit on. If we go back to sort of their vision and strategy, Albert, they've got this sort of cluster of number one strategy, which is, I think, a terrible title for their strategy. But the general idea is they want to create a diverse group of companies with outstanding technologies, business models in certain fields. And then by all sort of being under the umbrella of SoftBank, you can have these synergies of these companies, I guess, sort of incubating together in a way, having founders that can talk to each other, share resources, ideas. What do we think of this strategy? It's something that we've seen before, particularly in Asia.
Yeah, it's hard to really verify the truth of this in terms of how collaborative their portfolio companies are. In some of their annual reports, they do talk about how they've kind of gone into the weeds, particularly through COVID, in support of their founders. But they've just got so many portfolio companies across the world. Like, I imagine it's quite hard to get founder to founders to talk to each other. But this is a common play in any kind of holding company, where if you hold a bunch of investments, you generally want your investments to interact with each other, like either through like knowledge sharing, or maybe there's customers. So you could have a business that sells software that maybe some of your other portfolio companies would use. And it just kind of adds and reinforces the value of these businesses when they start working in together. You can do introductions, you can meet customers, you can share product knowledge. So that's kind of a default state, but I'm not sure how collaborative they truly are, given how fragmented, and also the spectrum to which they play, right? Like, you've got them investing in Alibaba, which is an incredibly mature business. And then you also have them investing in, you know, like a tiny startup in India, you know, who may not necessarily be at the same stage, who there's language barriers, there's geographical barriers. Yes, I'm not sure exactly what the scale and success of the collaboration is.
Yeah, I mean, you can see some names there and you can draw those links. But as you say, Albert, I think in the whole, it's hard to decipher how across the board, how methodical, how real is this competitive advantage, as they put it. You know, in my mind, I look on the page and I see investments in Didi, earlier investments in Uber. Well, obviously there's a synergy there to sort of car sharing, ride sharing applications in different markets that did actually compete against each other at one point. I'm just going to finish up on this second part of the strategy, Albert, and then we can hit something else. But this idea of having a flexible management style by not taking controlling stakes generally in their investments, and this is something that we've seen particularly in Asia with their sort of What's the word for it, Albert? It's the conglomerate style where...
Oh, like the keiretsu?
Correct, the keiretsu. So, I mean, this is just, again, a manifestation of that in an Asian company. Similarly, what's our take on it?
Yeah, I think they're very different from a keiretsu, but they've got so many characteristics of it. So they've got, you know, this conglomerate business that predominantly used to play in telco. And they've built out a business around that. And now they've transformed into a holding company in the same way that we've seen a lot of kind of keiretsus do it, like Samsung and Sony, who've got these, you know, weird business units and things that don't necessarily make sense or fit their core competency, but they can reinforce parts of their business in strange ways as a result of that. And they can also build an ecosystem around themselves as a result of that. And you can kind of see it in SoftBank. I think the key difference, and, you know, feel free to shout out Dan if you disagree, is that SoftBank don't seem to actively get involved in their like day-to-day operations and try draw out kind of synergies between each portfolio companies explicitly to launch new products. They kind of just like let them be.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the thought I had. You know, if you've got a, you know, the head of the snake in Sony or wherever it might be, which is sort of, Alibaba is a good one as well, because they take a lot of minority stakes in companies. You know, they've got a sort of vision or strategy as a company, as an overall business that they're shooting for. Whereas SoftBank's, it seems much more just, you know, like they want the individual investments to be successful, etc. But they're not, there's no overarching structure which is helping these companies sort of work together and have those synergies. So yeah, I think it's a little bit of a misnomer that this is sort of the Keiretsu style that other companies we've looked at have. Albert, we've talked a lot about SoftBank, the vision, a little bit about the CEO, the strategy. What do you want to hit?
I want to talk about what the future of SoftBank looks like, and then let's talk about East and West comparisons.
Yep.
I think like right now they've obviously been like ravaged by the markets, and Masa had a really great kind of earnings call earlier this week, and he talked about his plan. He feels really like humbled. He's kind of ashamed that this has happened. But, you know, I was reading this really interesting article this morning where they actually discussed how Masa was the person who's lost the most money in the world, in the history of the world, in early 2000s. So he in the early 2000s, he was the person who had lost the most money in the history of the world as a result of the tech bubble bursting, you know, and he held Alibaba, he held Yahoo, etc. Now that's probably likely to happen again. He's probably the person who's lost the most money in the world, just given the sheer size of SoftBank and everything it does. Like, how do you see this playing out, Dan? Do you think this is cyclical for SoftBank? Do you think this is like kind of the end of the line for Masa?
No, I don't think it's cyclical. I think this is the diamond hands equivalent for the tech world. Because he's holding on. And so you can see that in the actions of SoftBank. So they've just recently announced that from mid-August, the end of September, they're selling down their ownership in Alibaba, their most successful investment. They're going to go from a 23% stake to about a 14% stake, which is a huge, huge reduction. But that's going to net them about $34 billion in cash. And the whole idea of that is that's to cement their position during this downturn, balance the books, and just sort of give them certainty going forward. So that to me signals that they're in it for the long run. You know, they're selling down their major winner and they're going to double down on this strategy. And like you said, I kind of believe in the strategy. If you look at their companies they're invested in, like Coupang, it's a whole bunch of companies that we've looked at, Albert, and a lot of them we've said we'd like. And the reason we've looked at them is because we think those are, if not the businesses, they're at the very least the segments of business which are going to do really well in the future. They're going to drive the innovations of tomorrow. So to me, I think this is sort of an evergreen company. As long as it can withstand the temporary ups and downs of the market, I think the strategy in the long term is going to return.
Yeah, I think it's also, it's in a unique position because it can, and it has so much money that it can just deploy capital where it needs to go. And so when you've got a company like Coupang, like pre-Coupang going public, and they were looking for sources of capital, like the really only investor you've got are like private equity firms and SoftBank. And if you're trying to get like a multi-million or multi-billion dollar check, you're probably going to go to a company like SoftBank over a private equity fund or, you know, like a bank because they've got the track record. And so by nature of that, by the time a company gets to the mature stage where they're asking SoftBank for billions of dollars, like they're probably already successful and on their way to a pretty good exit or at least a exit in the public markets. And I think that's what SoftBank's going for. It's like it's chosen to play in a particular segment of the market, which is like investing in, you know, high growth technology businesses that are maturing and could exit. And based on that, there's no one else playing in that because no one else has the capital to play in that. And they're going to be successful when the market upturns.
Yeah, there's an interesting competitive advantage here, just on the terms of the scale of the investments they're making, Albert, as you've been talking about. I saw an article, this was 2019, but I couldn't believe the numbers. But essentially, you know, the $100 billion that SoftBank had at its disposal back then, was apparently more than the entire VC industry, which was about $55 billion at the time, which I didn't realize the VC industry was that kind of small. But that gives you an idea of the scale of advantage they're playing at. They're essentially bigger than all the competition combined, which means that they can have their pick of companies. And just to make it, you know, a tangible example, one of their investments at the time was DoorDash, you know, the delivery startup. And as soon as they invested their hundreds of millions of dollars in it, they overtook Uber Eats in terms of market share in a particular jurisdiction. And the CEO of Uber was basically like, yeah, why do you think that happened? They deployed the cash cannon at us. And so that's the kind of effect that SoftBank has with these startups, particularly in areas where you can just deploy cash to acquire customers.
For sure. And this makes their portfolio look better. Like in kind of private market investing, there's a rule of thumb called last money in. And so, you know, the value of the business at its current stand is the value of it was last time money came into the business. So when SoftBank comes and invests in a company, they'll value it. And so now that business is valued at whatever SoftBank has decided to invest it at. If that company decides to raise again, SoftBank then gets to decide, because it's generally the large investor, what the valuation of that company is. So it can kind of overinflate the value of the businesses that it has, which works out really well in a bull market when those companies go public, because SoftBank's kind of inflated or written the valuations at each stage. But in a private market like now, we've started to see that play out quite negatively.
All right, Albert, East versus West, what's your comparator?
Yeah, good. This is good. I think we were talking about this before we started recording. I say Berkshire. Couple of good comparison points. First is like kind of like lead investor with the halo effect or kind of some aura around them. So you've got Massa versus Warren Buffett. Like obviously Buffett is a hugely coveted and like famous investor. And then Massa, kind of this eccentric investor who's got kind of this aura around him based on his history as well. So Berkshire is probably the direct comparison, I think.
I think that's the best one. I really, really liked it because, you know, they've also got different strategies, but the sort of bones or the structure of the business are pretty much the same. The idea that you have, you know, these reinforcing businesses. Berkshire focuses a lot more on, you know, cash flow certainty, really strong fundamental businesses, while SoftBank focusing on those, you know, 1 in 100 hits in the tech industry. I think it's just like a really interesting dynamic to look at there. I was trying to think of another one, and I think it's really, really tough. I came up with Google just because of the idea that they're so active in acquiring what tends to be younger, smaller tech businesses. But the difference, as you pointed out, Albert, is that, you know, Google's got a core product. And usually when they are acquiring businesses, they're bringing those products sort of into the fold to further enhance the core. Whereas SoftBank obviously, you know, doesn't have that same prerogative. They're not acquiring these businesses to prop up or further their telecom e-commerce business.
Yeah, I think Google's also a pretty good comparison. I mean, it is interesting because when we look at Google versus SoftBank, they're almost the opposite in a way, where you've got Google who acquires things and wants to integrate everything together. Like they want every part of their product suite all integrated. I don't necessarily see that kind of push from SoftBank across their portfolios. And obviously that's harder because they're all separate businesses.
And maybe this goes back to the point that SoftBank's approach is minority investments. Google is, for the most part, you know, majority acquisitions. I think that, you know, they're taking the whole pie.
Yeah, I think the probably non-traditional comparison I would make is like a private equity firm called Silver Lake, who is based in America and invests in technology companies and kind of famously invested in Twitter and installed a couple of board members who like allegedly forced Jack out as part of that investment. But, you know, I think Berkshire and Google are really good comparison points.
Anything else you want to hit before we start finishing up, Albert?
I think, you know, just quickly, Dan, do you think anyone else could replicate what they do?
they'll need the money. I think that's really, really tough. And this goes back to a point which maybe we breezed over a little bit, but it's not like SoftBank has got all of this money just from them. They're essentially, you know, pitching their bona fides to other funds around the world and saying, give us your capital and we'll allocate it. And where they're getting the capital from is the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund. You know, that's a significant part of their capital. And a lot of people have criticized that because obviously there are some human rights issues with the source of that capital. I mean, I don't know if you want to dive into that at all, Albert.
Oh, I mean, I reckon we could probably do a whole episode on what the Saudi investment fund's been doing, to be honest. I probably don't want to get too much into it now, but definitely a criticism a lot of people have had on SoftBank. But I think if you have that criticism, you should dive into the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund and actually look at what they're investing in, because it really will surprise you at how deep their money goes now.
Yeah, and that's to say, it's almost like, in sports, it's called sports washing, where you have, you know, the sovereign wealth funds, which invest in a sports team, and obviously fans are very passionate about their sports team, so it sort of gives this aura or halo effect or, you know, side benefit in terms of reputation. A critic could say SoftBank is essentially just a nicer face of the Saudi wealth fund, which is allocating capital into these businesses, but ultimately, you know, it's for the benefit and for the prerogative of the sovereign wealth fund in Saudi Arabia. So I think it's an interesting sort of side note to SoftBank as a business.
Yeah, and I mean, I do definitely want to stay clear of talking about the Saudi sovereign wealth fund, but like, you know, they've invested in almost everything, right? Like Uber, Nintendo. Mm-hmm. You know, gaming companies, Boeing, like it's hard to boycott the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund for human rights issues because they've just got their capital everywhere. And let's probably just leave it at that.
Yeah, let's not get into a sticky situation now, but let's go to verdicts. What's your verdict?
Look, I really like what SoftBank's doing and really like how it's kind of transformed the technology landscape. I think if you take a really long view, like let's say take the 300-year view, like they're going to be super successful. Like Masa hits home runs. He's historically hit home runs his entire life. Market's cyclical. And because he's the person with the most capital, he's going to be the person with the most loss as well. And that's just a market play.
Yeah. I mean, what I found so interesting was probably over the 5 years of articles that I was reading, you know, from 1 year, the article's thesis is, you know, Musa's a fallen king. He's lost the most money in the year, et cetera, et cetera. And then the next year, it's the complete opposite article. It's, you know, saying, oh, actually, he was a genius in disguise. He's recovered. And that's just like the huge swings associated with SoftBank, the business that it's in, and the strategy that they're deploying. If we do play it out, maybe not 300 years, but even just a couple of decades, I think on the whole, it's hard to really commit to them being successful because it depends on whether they do get that one-hit wonder. And maybe that's my core criticism, Albert, is if I look at the current stable of investments, I don't know who the next Alibaba is. And if they don't have another Alibaba, can they be successful? I think that's sort of where my key question is at the moment.
I don't think that they can look at their portfolio and even know who the next Alibaba is as like fund managers. I think they stay close and have the right indicators. And so I think where they're going to win as a portfolio of businesses is the fact that they've just got so much capital to deploy, because the next Alibaba who is looking for cash is going to go to SoftBank.
That's a nice way of putting it. Yeah, I like that. All right, any last words, Albert?
No, I think this is a good episode. I'm glad we got to look at SoftBank. Yeah.
All right, let's finish up there. Thank you for listening to Fresh Capital, a podcast about companies and investing told in a refreshingly simple way. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week, we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn how companies operate and how investing works. Just a reminder, All information contained in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, financial, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Fresh Capital are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any opinions expressed in the show are not recommendations or advice. Please consult a licensed financial professional before you jump in. As always, we look forward to seeing you next week. See ya!